loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, President Trump this morning unceremoniously fired Secretary of State Rex Tillerson by tweet, and he moved CIA Director Mike Pompeo to the Secretary of State position. Meanwhile, CIA Deputy Director Gina Haspel, alleged to have been intimately involved in the agency's torture program, will become director if confirmed by the Senate. And then today in our second segment, we talk, as we do every Tuesday, about the big economic stories of the week. We're going to look at the massive corporate mergers, the deregulation of the banks, and the impact of Donald Trump's announced tariffs on aluminum and steel.
But before we get to Tillerson's firing, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, the Republicans on the House Intelligence Committee released an unusual and partisan report yesterday, concluding that there was no collusion between the Russian government and either the Trump or Clinton campaigns. Significantly, the report, however, perpetuates the narrative that the Russians launched cyber attacks against American institutions. Again, no actual hard proof of this assertion has been offered. The report said that several Trump campaign officials had made poor decisions, but that no crimes were committed. Next, British Prime Minister Theresa May said yesterday that Sergei Skripal, a former Russian double agent for the British, who was poisoned last week along with his daughter, was likely the victim of a Russian assassination attempt. The Russian government is demanding proof, and the high-stakes international mystery is deepening. Then students across America will walk out of schools tomorrow in a nationwide protest against gun violence. The National School Walkout is both a memorial to those killed by guns and a protest of government inaction. And then Education Secretary Betsy DeVos on Sunday gave what many observers are calling a train wreck of an interview to the news program 60 Minutes. DeVos struggled to answer basic questions about the nation's schools and failed to defend President Trump's school safety ideas. And finally, a Saudi general may have been tortured to death and several businessmen abused while in captivity at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh during Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's crackdown on powerful figures in that country. The Crown Prince has systematically arrested, purged, or exiled virtually anybody who could pose a threat to him. And in other headlines, Turkish forces and their allies have reportedly begun to seize the city of Afrin in northern Syria. Afrin is under the control of the Kurdish YPG militia, who have been reinforced in recent days by forces loyal to the Syrian government. Turkish President Erdogan insists that his army's invasion of Afrin is just the beginning of a broader push to oust the YPG from power along the Turkish-Syrian border. According to Politico, the Trump administration is considering tough new tariffs targeting China. The report claims that U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer proposed $30 billion worth of penalties, and Trump insisted on making the trade measures even tougher. The administration is already under fire for its controversial tariffs imposed on aluminum and steel. White House aide John McEntee was fired and escorted out of the White House today. McEntee was fired reportedly because he's under investigation by the Department of Homeland Security for serious financial crimes. However, Donald Trump is standing by McEntee. Immediately following his departure, the Trump re-election campaign announced that McEntee would be hired as a senior advisor for campaign operations. A bomb blast targeted Palestinian Prime Minister Rami Hamdallah's convoy today as he was driving through Gaza. Hamdallah was unharmed, but several of his bodyguards were injured. The attack has increased tension between the Palestinian Authority, led by Hamdallah and President Mahmoud Abbas, and Hamas, which governs the besieged Gaza Strip. Those are today's headlines. Next up is Tillerson's firing. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the firing of Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State by Donald Trump. President Trump this morning unceremoniously fired his Secretary of State, Mr. Tillerson, by tweet, and he moved CIA Director Mike Pompeo to Secretary of State. Meanwhile, CIA Deputy Director Gina Haspel, alleged to have been intimately involved in the agency's torture program, will become the director if confirmed by the Senate. We're joined from Baltimore by Kevin Zeese. He's the co-coordinator of Popular Resistance. You can check out his work at popularresistance.org. We're joined from New York by Jeremy Varon. He is a professor at the New School in New York. and an anti-Guantanamo, anti-torture activist. And we're joined from New York City by Ted Rawl. He is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
Ted Rawl, let's start with you. Of course it was by tweet. Of course, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, who Donald Trump said many months ago, Rex, stop wasting your time, when Tillerson suggested that there should be negotiations with the DPRK. Of course he did it by tweet. But nonetheless, there may be policy implications. I want to get your take on that. Mike Pompeo will now take Rex Tillerson's place. What's your initial reaction?
Well, as usual with the Trump administration, we're going from bad to worse. Rex Tillerson was a terrible choice for Secretary of State, former CEO of ExxonMobil. What the hell was Donald Trump thinking, one wondered at the time. And now we go from him to a paranoid spy master and a person who didn't exactly cover himself with glory as the leader of the Benghazi witch hunt investigation, which dragged on and got pretty much nowhere for years, which its sole purpose seemed to be, let's get Hillary Clinton. I think the policy implications are frightening. Donald Trump, in my view, had just last week embarked on one of the few initiatives that I could get behind, namely, let's talk to North Korea. And, I think we should talk to everyone. And now, instead, what we've got is we have the hardliner coming in the form of Pompeo. And it's not hard to imagine the North Korea talks being changed to one going back to requiring preconditions or even having the talks canceled entirely. I hope that doesn't happen, but I'm crossing my fingers on that.
Okay, Kevin Zeese, real quickly, what about that? What about its implications for North Korea? But also, Mike Pompeo was a super hawk in Congress against, and during his tenure as the CIA, against the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, also known as the Iran nuclear arms deal. May 12th is the date by which Trump has to certify whether or not the U.S. considers Iran to be compliant. All signs indicate that Trump is trying to sabotage the agreement. Let's talk about the policy implications.
I think those are two very related questions, North Korea and the Iran agreement. I mean, Tillerson was on borrowed time ever since he called Trump a moron. Pompeo is the opposite. He's been like a kiss-up to Trump. He's like covered him on everything he said. So it's a very different personality relationship. Pompeo has said that regime change is more important than denuclearization in the Korea Peninsula. So that's his priority, is to change the government to one that's more U.S. friendly. So I don't see much good coming out of the North Korea talks anymore. I was hopeful, just like Ted. I think Ted is right. There are various ways the talks could be called off. But it's also likely if the talks go forward, they end up producing nothing positive and become a launching ground for more aggression. This especially is true if Pompeo is able to convince Trump, who I think is already leaning this way, to back out of the Iran nuclear deal. If the Iran nuclear deal falls down, why would North Korea agree to anything with the United States? The United States negotiates a deal, backs off on it. North Korea's history with the United States is Clinton negotiates a deal, Bush doesn't follow through on it. So the U.S. is kind of a welcher. You know, why would anyone negotiate anything with the United States with that kind of history? So I don't see much positive coming out of North Korea or Iran. I see a much more hawkish administration. My fear is Trump is preparing for 2020 and believes the masses need an opiate, a commander-in-chief at war.
Yeah, interesting. Jeremy Varon, you're an activist, an advocate in the struggle against torture, of course, and for closing Guantanamo. We have a situation where, let's read Donald Trump's original tweet from this morning. Mike Pompeo, director of the CIA, will become our new Secretary of State. He will do a fantastic job. Of course he will. Thank you to Rex Tillerson for his service. Gina Haspel will become the new director of the CIA and the first woman so chosen. Congratulations to all. My co-host, John Kiriakou, wrote an article at the time that Gina Haspel was appointed by Trump to be deputy director of the CIA. I want to read a couple words from his article, Jeremy Varon, and then have you comment. President Donald Trump's appointment of Gina Haspel as deputy director of the CIA is the clearest sign yet that the president has come down on the side of those at the agency who were the architects of the Bush-era torture policy, Haspel was a protege of Jose Rodriguez, the CIA's notorious former counterterrorism center CTC director. Furthermore, the Times reports it was Haspel who ordered the destruction of videotapes showing that Abu Zubaydah torture sessions on orders from Rodriguez. Abu Zubaydah was captured in Pakistan in 2002 and waterboarded, I think, 83 times even after he had been cooperating with the FBI. So what does it mean for torture, Jeremy?
I mean, I think that it's grotesque that she's being elevated to lead the CIA. And then with a long view of things, there are senior members of the Bush administration, people all throughout the ranks in the CIA and others who by all rights should be in jail for having violated domestic and international law prohibiting torture. And yet those sins have been, you know, washed away over the years, enabling somebody deeply guilty of grave crimes to enjoy the prestige of leading one of America's preeminent national security institutions. And it's horrifying the extent to which the United States brazenly violates its own stated principles, commitment to the rule of law, human rights, and so forth. And Trump represents an escalation of that hypocrisy, but the die was cast even under the Obama administration that essentially gave a pass to people inside and beyond the CIA who are guilty of the crime of torture.
Yeah, it's really something that, you know, remember, Ted Rall, I'm sure you do remember that, that Trump made a point during the 2016 campaign that torture works. He also called for the killing of the family members of ISIS fighters, clearly things that are not legal. I'm looking at the New Yorker article from February 3rd, 2017, written by Dexter Filkins, the new CIA deputy chief's black site past. From 2003 to 2005, Gina Haspel was a senior official overseeing a top secret CIA program that subjected dozens of suspected terrorists to savage interrogations, which included depriving them of sleep, squeezing them into coffins, and forcing water down their throats. In 2002, Haspel was among the CIA officers present at the interrogation of Abu Zubaydah, an al-Qaeda suspect who was tortured so brutally that at one point he appeared dead. Ted Rall, it's Torture Inc. all over again, right?
It is, and it prompts a couple of thoughts. I guess it certainly is Exhibit A in the idea that if putting women in charge doesn't necessarily help if they're the wrong women. It also is it's also a reminder of the necessity of prosecuting torturers when you have the chance. When President Obama came in to office in 2009, one of the first things he did was to visit the CIA in Langley and assure the agents there that there would be no prosecutions, that it was time to look forward, not backwards, and that they were that the Bush-era torture was not going to be prosecuted, that CIA agents could operate with impunity. The importance of prosecuting torturers is that if you don't, they end up running the agency, apparently. So, we don't, you know, does this mean torture is coming back tomorrow? From what I read and what I hear, there isn't much appetite within the agency for repeating that. But obviously, we might just be one terrorist attack away from another change of policy. She should have been warming a prison cell for the last decade or so. And it's appalling that she's about to be elevated like this. And I would also throw down a gauntlet and say that any Democrat who votes for her confirmation is scum.
Amen.
Yeah, amen. John Kiriakou, Ted Rall made the point it's important to prosecute torturers. But in your case, you were the person, the only person in from the CIA who went to prison for the torture program, not because you tortured, but because you told the truth about the torture program, about its existence. We wouldn't perhaps even know about it, or certainly the public wouldn't have known about it when it knew about it, except for your admission. So the government, instead of prosecuting the torturers, and again, here she is, the new head of the CIA, they prosecuted you.
Yeah, they prosecuted me. And, you know, I want to expound on something that Ted said that's so important. When Barack Obama went to the CIA in February of 2009 and said that we need to look forward, not look backward, that's fine and good if you are a working level CIA officer and you have been told that the president has approved and the Justice Department has approved these techniques. If you are are convinced, you've been convinced by your superiors that you are acting legally. All right, I understand. I may not agree with it, but I understand looking forward, not looking backward. But that's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about here is that the torture program under the command of Gina Haspel murdered people in custody. People were murdered while they were being interrogated. The Justice Department never said Gina Haspel could murder people. The Justice Department similarly never told Gina Haspel that she could destroy the videotaped evidence of the torture. In fact, both the Justice Department and the White House General Counsel ordered that the CIA not destroy those tapes. It was Gina Haspel who destroyed those tapes. And so she has proven time and time again that she has no respect for the law. She has no respect for the Constitution. She certainly is not weighed down by moral or ethical concerns. I think it's wonderful that a woman is being considered to lead the CIA. It's about time. But that woman should not be Gina Haspel.
Let's talk about, you know, the argument made by Trump that torture works. Sean Kiriakou, before you were, and I'll come back to Kevin in a moment, but I want to go back to this because when you were one of our early guests on this show and before you were a co-host, I asked you, why did they torture Abu Zubaydah when he was already talking to the FBI and had been talking for a long time? He no longer had any actionable intelligence. And you said to me at the time, you said they tortured for torture's sake. In other words, it wasn't about efficacy. They set up a power, a bureaucracy, and it just kept churning, and it kept churning out victims. You know, we can't, when we talk about murder, you can't say, let's move forward. You can't say, oh, that was in the past.
Right.
There has to be, if you pretend even to be have the rule of law, there has to be accountability. You can't just go forward. That can't be a political edict. I'm just not going to prosecute murder.
Right, exactly.
Unless the murderers are high enough, mm-hmm. big enough, mm-hmm. more important enough. Kevin Z, it really says something that we're here again. It's almost like... you know, almost like deja vu all over again. We're back to 2001, 2002. There hasn't been a new major massive terrorist attack, but all those who brought torture and made America Torture Inc., and of course it didn't start the torture in America, but, you know, quote, legalized it.
Mainstreamed it.
They're back and they're mainstream. Go ahead.
Well, I think that's important that torture is not just from the Bush administration. It has a long history in the United States. It was mentioned taught in CIA schools and CIA manuals going back to the 1950s. So this is not new. What is sad, though, is that Gina Haspel is getting a promotion. She's gotten award after award after award. This is not uncommon, by the way. People who commit war crimes for the United States, they get awards. That's part of the cover to protect them. And so not all awards are for that reason, but many awards are. And I think Gina's awards are that and her promotions are that. If there was a conflict in the CIA over torture, the torturers have won. Now, if we had an opposition party in this country, we would see this as an opportunity to put torture on trial, especially with Pompeo, who calls torturers patriots, and with Haspel, who conducted torture and covered for torture, destroyed evidence of torture. This is an opportunity to put torture on trial, but unfortunately we don't have an opposition party. Torture is bipartisan. The military-industrial complex is bipartisan. Barack Obama wanted to turn the page on torture. This is an opportunity that we miss because we don't have a real two-party system or a multi-party system.
Jeremy, I'd like to spend the entire time talking about what this means in terms of torture, legitimizing torture, etc. But we have to deal with some other subjects, which is the policy or potential policy implications of this shift. There's been lots of shifts already in the first 13, 14 months of the Trump administration. Tillerson was the CEO of ExxonMobil, certainly the biggest oil company in the world and one of the biggest companies and biggest corporations in the world. It was Robert Gates who originally had suggested to Donald Trump that he think about Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State. This was before Trump had expected to win the presidency and thus was sort of empty-handed in terms of who he would turn to for foreign policy. He couldn't always turn to George Papadopoulos after all. Jeremy, what do you think the implications are, and why do you think Trump fired Tillerson?
As to the implications, your other guests, I think, spoke very eloquently to dangers with respect to North Korea. I would like to pivot a little bit to Iran and express my worry that the United States seems itching for an outright war with Iran. The war in Yemen already is functioning as a kind of proxy war. I think the United States would love regime change in Iran, and perhaps in Director Pompeo have a Secretary of State who is more committed to a war path with Iran. In terms of Trump's motivations, who at this point knows? The fellow's so hypersensitive, he's so mercurial, he's so prone to having a bruised ego. It could be a personal and personality quarrel as much as indication of any kind of meaningful policy preference. And in general, the chaos in the White House is vertiginous, and it makes being a citizen difficult on a daily basis when you don't know what sickening surprise is going to greet you any given morning. I can say that I'm exhausted by this all and covet a return to normalcy, even knowing that that normalcy is the institutionalization of torture and a long history of American crimes, but I would rather fight them within a sort of an old landscape of political struggle. I'm having a hard time coping with the mania from the executive these days.
Ted Rall, in his goodbye speech to the State Department, or that part of the State Department staff that hadn't already lost their jobs during the Tillerson rule, Tillerson said today, "We exceeded everyone's expectations with DPRK maximum pressure campaign." Now, I have to say, from my point of view, that's completely bizarre, absurd, ridiculous, and just not true. I don't think Kim Jong-un was trembling in Pyongyang. I don't think the reason that there's momentum for talks between North and South Korea had anything to do with maximum pressure. I think Kim Jong-un and Moon Jae-in have created momentum for their own reasons, and the Americans were sort of not on the diplomatic train as it was leaving the station, and Trump has tried to jump onto that train in a sort of dramatic way. But it's not about maximum pressure. In fact, if anything, Tillerson and the Trump administration have pushed North and South Korea closer together. Because guess what? People in the Korean Peninsula don't actually want a war that will kill, millions of people. Let's talk a little bit about that here. It seems to me, even as he's leaving, Tillerson is not, well, he's certainly not calling Trump a moron, which presumably he said privately. He's actually embracing the same political kind of concept or ideology of the Trump administration, this bullying approach towards the DPRK, or we'll see it next, as Jeremy said, towards Iran, that's the big ticket. That's the way America can succeed. Anyway, go ahead.
I think that one thing that listeners need to know, and I think many of them probably are aware of, is that the two Koreas have been attempting reunification talks almost since the end of the Korean War. And the United States repeatedly has stepped in and exerted pressure on the South not to cooperate with approaches from the North. And I think what kind of changed here is not, as you say, Brian, the incredible pressure from the West, which historically has just not worked. It's always tended to be counterproductive. It reminds me of Nixon bombing North Vietnam in preparation for the peace talks on Henry Kissinger's advice. It just doesn't work. But I think what happened here this time is that the Trump administration didn't have anyone to lean on the Koreas. I mean, there is no U.S. ambassador to South Korea. There is no U.S. envoy to North Korea, because neither of them have been appointed or confirmed by the Senate. And there is no undersecretary of state right now for East Asian for East Asia. So North and South Korea got together. They didn't have a chaperone, and they started to make out. And then it's like, okay, well, we come in, we don't want to be left out. And so Trump decided he would approve of this sort of tentatively. And that's sort of where we were last week. The ouster of Rex Tillerson obviously changes all that. But I think I don't think that this is a matter of political pressure, the pressure of the sanctions. The sanctions have been around for a long time. If anything, history shows that the sanctions tend to harden the resistance on the part of the victim nation.
Kevin, I want to get your take. Again, let's talk about Korea a little bit more. The Trump administration is making sounds like in spite of the change at the Secretary of State, and in spite of the fact that Mike Pompeo is a big hawk, that the, quote, talks going forward with the aim of denuclearization in the Korean Peninsula will continue. Of course, Trump has one agenda. The people in the government in North Korea and certainly the government in South Korea have a different agenda, which is essentially to stop a war from happening. But again, all of this is in a very compressed time period because Trump has promised to go forward with talks. I don't know if it'll actually happen, but with Kim Jong-un by the end of May. Anyway, your take.
My take is that, yes, there are very different interests between Trump and South Korea and North Korea. In fact, the South Korea-U.S. alliance was starting to become more distant as South Korea moved toward trying to figure out resolutions with North Korea to the conflict and maybe even reuniting. Trump almost had no choice but to join in. I mean, if he didn't join in, the South Korea would have gone ahead without him, and then what would have happened? It'd be out of his control. Now it's back in his control, and I think getting rid of Rex Tillerson, as these talks are supposedly coming about, putting in the hardliner who thinks that regime change is more important than denuclearization, Pompeo, for those negotiations, makes it very unlikely anything positive will come out, and it'll be used for U.S. purposes, which is regime change. The U.S. would be very happy to see reunification of the Koreas, but under U.S. allied empire. You know, they'd be very happy to have U.S. troops on the border of China and Russia if they could be in North Korea, if U.S. could be in North Korea. So there's a very different agenda. I think Trump had no choice but to get involved or risk losing the alliance with South Korea. And it's not surprising that this is false rhetoric about the hardline policy causing the negotiation. That's nonsense. North Korea has been calling for negotiation throughout the Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies. The U.S. has been escalating. North Korea has been wanting negotiations. And then we lie about Iran. We lie about Venezuela. We lie about Russia. This is what U.S. empire does. Both Trump, Tillerson, and our media puts out false information to villainize people who are rivals and potential military adversaries. That's just the reality of the U.S. way of existence.
I think those are important words, John, because as Kevin is saying, even though the personalities change and we want to assess whether they have policy implications, the deeper, more profound problem is the consensus. And the consensus is one about empire. The consensus is about the right of the United States to endlessly intervene in other countries' affairs, to determine and dominate other peoples and other regions. Now, perhaps to legalize, of course, something illegal can't be legalized, but torture Inc. once again. Anyway, those are the big issues, and we're going to keep, of course, following it. We're out of time. We've been joined from Baltimore by Kevin Zeese. Kevin is the co-coordinator of Popular Resistance. You can check out his work and the work of other people with his organization at popularresistance.org. We've been joined from New York City by Jeremy Varon. He is a professor at the New School in New York. He is an anti-Guantanamo activist, an anti-torture activist. And we've been joined from New York City by Ted Rawl. He is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You're listening to Loud and Clear after a short break. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we continue our weekly series looking at the top economic issues of the day. It's been a big week. Donald Trump imposed big tariffs, 25% tariffs on steel, 10% tariffs on aluminum. We're going to talk about those tariffs, and we're going to talk about the other issues of the day with Daniel Sankey. Daniel joins us from San Francisco, as he does every Tuesday. He is a financial policy analyst. Welcome back, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel, let's get started. Tariffs, big issue this week, 25% steel tariffs, 10% aluminum. Of course, Trump is also possibly providing waivers or exemptions for certain countries. These tariffs were imposed not on the basis of economic protectionism, even though they seem to be about economic protectionism. They were imposed on the basis of national security interests. Let's talk about what this means. You sent us an article, hung out to dry twice, Tennessee City stumped by Trump's washer tariffs. Talk about that story, if you would.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's an interesting story in that there's washing machine manufacturers that use certain washers that are imported from abroad, from overseas. And these new tariffs will cause the washers to kind of jump up in price significantly, and that will then have the downstream effect of impacting the washing machine manufacturers. This, you know, in the particular article, this particular Tennessee workers had a similar situation happen to them twice as different trade deals went through. What I find interesting about this article and that I wanted to kind of highlight is sort of how globalism kind of works and how significant a phenomenon this is, because the popular kind of, if the Trump administration had their way, the popular understanding would be that he's, you know, protecting U.S. jobs from, you know, those mean old foreign competitors that are taking all of them. And what we actually see in these situations is that there are actually a fair amount of foreign companies who set up shop here, employ U.S. workers, and then import inputs from abroad and assemble them here because ultimately it's cheaper. And when these tariffs go into effect, these kind of foreign companies and their foreign inputs get punished. But the downstream effect, of course, is that the workers themselves are the ones that see dropping wages and even layoffs as those companies are no longer able to be competitive because now they have this really huge artificial price increase. I think that's really important to point out because popular wisdom is that, you know, all the jobs are being moved abroad and it's all these foreign companies that now are doing it and U.S. workers are being hung out to dry. But there's also numerous instances of foreign companies coming to the U.S. and set up shop here and creating jobs that way as well. So it kind of shows how incredibly integrated this kind of global capitalist market is and how these kind of across-the-board tariffs impact so many different people in so many different ways and how destructive they can be.
We're speaking with Daniel Sankey from San Francisco. Daniel's a financial policy analyst, and he joins us every Tuesday to talk about the most important economic issues of the day. Daniel, you just finished that sentence with a very important point. I think most Americans, and certainly this administration, does not understand the overall impact of tariffs. It's certainly possible to have directed tariffs where you're trying to right a wrong, where somebody's dumping something at a cost or a price lower than their own cost. But these aren't really targeted sanctions, not when they're across the board 25% on steel and 10% on aluminum. Tell us what happens then in areas like, the South that has been attracting industry from Rust Belt states because they said, the company said that that wages were too high in the South. What happens now with prices going up?
Yeah, what happens now, unfortunately, is that the prices just plain go up across the board. So it trickles all the way down to the consumer. Those big companies, you know, those companies that are taking up residence in the South are not going to take a loss on this. They're going to do whatever they need to do to remain profitable. And unfortunately, a big part of that is getting rid of workers and reducing capacity because now they can't sell nearly as much because the prices are going up. This is, you know, under the guise of then U.S.-based with U.S. inputs, companies are going to kind of take their place and Americans will employ Americans and, you know, we'll make America great again. But the truth is that is an incredibly slow and long process. That deindustrialization is well underway from the 70s. It's been many decades. And these inputs can't be created here currently. We don't have the capacity, we don't have the factories, and we don't have the ability to do it. It's also incredibly expensive to build up that capacity. It costs a lot of money, and investors and corporations are going to go where the profits are. Well, where the profits are not in opening up all these new factories for these new inputs. Profits are typically in, you know, financialization and speculation and, you know, complex investments and derivatives and such. And that's what's, you know, attracting the lion's share of the capital. So, you know, these are incredibly destructive. And I think I said in a previous a segment that, you know, this is a very ideologically motivated administration. It's not, you know, this kind of very carefully planned politics. It's this idea that if it's America, it's good. If it's foreign, it's bad. And so we need to do something to just push out all the foreign, whatever that foreign is. And it's an incredibly, you know, inefficient, destructive. Ultimately, the downstream effect is that workers get hurt by this, and workers are the ones that are going to lose jobs and see a decrease in wages.
Daniel Sankey is making a really important point. And I have to say, because people don't understand how international trade works, they're vulnerable to deception and to self-deception.
That's right.
Mainly deception. Donald Trump practices deception all the time. He certainly did when he campaigned in southwestern Pennsylvania. And he said, we're bringing our steel back. We're bringing our aluminum back. And by the way, coal, the steel from the other countries is crap and et cetera, et cetera. Well, let's talk about what it means for China, say, to have imports to the United States, because he always says China's taking advantage of us.
They're stealing from us.
They're stealing from us very, very badly. I'm going to give you one example from a report that was published a few years ago in the Wall Street Journal. And I'm going to read a few sentences, because it goes right to what you're talking about, how international trade and globalization actually works. The Apple Corporation in the year 2010, the sale of Apple phones actually was listed as contributing $1.9 billion to the U.S. trade deficit with China, even though Apple is a U.S. corporation. And here's how it works. Trade statistics in both countries consider the iPhone a Chinese export to the United States, even though it is entirely designed and owned by a U.S. company and is made largely of parts produced in several Asian and European countries. China's contribution is the last step. Remember that, the last step, assembling and shipping the phones back, say, to the United States or elsewhere. So the entire, at that time, 2010, $178.96 estimated wholesale cost of the shipped phone is credited to China. Even though the value of the work performed by the Chinese workers at Hanhai Precision Industry accounts for just 3.6%, that's $6.50 out of the $198 of the total price. So as a consequence, because the product is assembled, last step, it's assembled partly designed in the U.S. or in Europe, produced in other countries, including Europe and including other Asian countries, finally assembled in China, and then shipped back to the United States. But because it comes from China, it has a made in China label. And that's where the distortion appears. And as a consequence, you don't really know in that $198 iPhone, now $1,000 with the iPhone 10, how much is actually produced in China, even though it appears in statistics that it all comes from China, because that was the last step in the assembly. Go ahead, Daniel.
Yeah, it really shows how important terminology is for these sorts of things. I mean, I think in the 80s, obesity rates spiked because the FDA suddenly one year changed the standards by which obesity is measured. So suddenly a whole bunch of people who weren't obese the year before became obese. And so, you know, if you just look at that, you might think, oh, everybody had a huge weight problem in the 80s, but really just the terminology changed. The same thing with the Chinese inputs. This global network of how things come together and are assembled is incredibly complex, involves many, many countries, all producing inputs in different ways. And these corporations have, over the decades, built up these complex supply chains, bringing them together. And then in the end, it just becomes China. You know, I think we have to ask ourselves, why are they using such kind of sloppy, lazy statistics? Because it seems like, you know, economists would want to understand the very complex nature of all the inputs that go to create things, because they really want to understand the global economy. I think there's also a certain disingenuity there, in that by pointing the finger at China, by saying it's all China, even though it's like less than 4%, there's an ideological motivation there. There is pitting this country as our enemy, as the one who's taking our jobs, who's taking our wealth, and kind of taking over society. Everyone jokes that everywhere you go, it's got a made in China label on it, you know. And of course, they do a great deal of the assembly, and based on the standards, that's what it's called. But I think it's, you know, it's dishonest. And I think that's the point. As you know, China is rising as a global power, both economically, it's growing militarily, it's, you know, gaining real strength and influence. This is going to be used as an opportunity, especially by this administration, to demonize them and to point them out how they're taking over our society and culture. We need to be smarter than that, and we need to realize the kind of complex dynamics that come into play. Currently today, China is not some kind of, you know, superpower when compared to the U.S. The U.S. has vast amounts of greater of wealth, of military expenditure, of power and influence. And trying to pretend like China can bully the U.S. or push the U.S. around is absurd. I mean, it's just simply fantasy.
Daniel, I don't want to oversimplify this, but is it that this administration just doesn't understand globalization? Do they just not understand the global economy? You know, when there's a campaign, for example, in the Midwest, and I saw this on television the last time I was in the Midwest, there's a campaign to buy John Deere, right? But the John Deeres are made in places like Mexico and Japan and Taiwan, and you're not supposed to buy Matsumoto or whatever the other one is. And in fact, it's made in Kansas. So is it that our leaders just don't understand globalization and that things may not be as plain and simple as they believe they are?
I think they definitely understand globalization. I don't think they're stupid, but I think they are opportunists. And I think that they're going to spin these particular events however is helpful. So if their campaign can benefit from the image that John Deere is being taken over by foreigners and this kind of American backbone is now going to be owned by, you know, some Asian company or country, if that can help rally the voters, if that can help gain support, then that's the angle they're going to go after it. I think the same thing goes with the Trump administration. You know, he has made it clear that his focus is going to be on playing to his base, building up his base, and this tariffs and these attacks on these other countries economically is just part of it. I mean, if you remember, not too long ago, Steve Bannon was in the White House, and Steve Bannon was very explicitly clear that China is the enemy, that we have about a decade to take them on and defeat them before they're going to get so powerful that we can't possibly stand against them. And I think that ideology is still very alive and well, both in his base and amongst a lot of the people in the administration has supporting them. So, they're not stupid. This is a calculated arrangement. This is a way of garnering support. This is a way to prove that they're going to fight for the little guy. They're going to fight for the worker that's getting their jobs taken away by these, you know, evil foreigners. And so I think that it's a tactical move.
One of the elements that's at play with protectionism is that it binds the workers to the company, to their bosses. And it's sort of the opposite of what might be called classic trade union or class consciousness. It's identifying workers with their bosses to think, if it's good for the company, it's going to be good for me. But in fact, that's not necessarily true. And generally speaking, not ever true. Because if the company, meaning the investors, meaning the owners, if they get excess amounts of dollars or whatever currency they're working in, that means they have additional power to, say, replace living labor workers with machines, which cost more, you know, in terms of original investment. The main reason, Daniel Sankey, for the loss of U.S. steel jobs is actually a huge increase, and people have to wrap their heads around this, as a huge increase in worker productivity, not imports. And as a consequence, the loss of jobs because workers are more productive, because they're using more technology and more advanced technology, those jobs are gone because they won't be living jobs. I mean, jobs for living human beings. In 1980, it took about 10.1, what is called in the statistics, man hours, but let's call them people hours, to produce 1 ton of steel in the United States. 10.1 people hours. In 2017, it took 1.5 labor hours, people worker power, to produce that same 1 ton of steel. So there's been a diminution of the amount of labor necessary to produce a ton of steel by 85%. That means the living laborers are that much more productive. And as a consequence, the company can continue to replace living labor with even more productive machines. And guess what? The machines don't take bathroom breaks. They don't complain. They're not part of a union. They don't grieve when they've been maligned by management. It's just better. Go ahead, Daniel.
Yeah, that's the real transformation that we're seeing here. It's not this, you know, pushing them out to other workers out to other countries or they'll do it for cheaper. Certainly that exists and that's a factor. But the reality is there's been this incredible technological revolution, especially since the 70s, that has automated a great deal of this, that has pushed, you know, workers down to where it takes so much fewer of them to do what they were needed to do in the past. I think also that's an important thing to understand is that, you know, this divides up the workers and binds them to their bosses. The reality is, you know, workers in a factory in China scrambling around trying to make a buck, working long days, being exhausted, you know, to push out microchips or whatever it is they're assembling, really have more in common with workers here in the U.S. who are doing the same thing, scrambling around, trying to feed their families, make a dollar, assemble things, et cetera, and get outputs going out there. And yet, this kind of tariff war, this sort of anti-immigrant language, this hostile to China language that we hear is specifically used to divide those two groups of people, to make workers in the U.S. to think that workers in China are the enemy, that they're the problem, when in fact they're just as exploited as they are, they're just as precarious and desperate for work as they are, and that really the truth is it is the corporations over them, the corporations that have operations in China and in the U.S., the corporations that can move their capital anywhere they please should they choose to, as opposed to workers who are, you know, set in a particular society and community and place. They can't just pick up and leave easily. They're the ones that are the pushing down wages. They're the ones that are reaping super profits. And ultimately, they are the ones that workers need to organize against.
Daniel, it's not just Chinese workers. There was something in the news yesterday that I think is pretty important. And that was that President Trump has blocked Broadcom's bid to buy Qualcomm. Broadcom is Singapore-based, and Qualcomm, of course, is an American communications, telecommunications company. But the president didn't cite competition as the reason for this. He cited national security. So why would a Singaporean company be a problem in national security?
Well, the reason why he keeps citing national security, and this also goes for his previous tariffs, is that he can do it kind of through executive order. So he doesn't need to go through a process where there's checks and balances. If it's a matter of national security, the idea of the legislation was that the president should be able to act quickly because, you know, people could be at risk, lives could be at risk. What he's doing is he's actually taking advantage of that particular caveat in the law so that he could just by fiat declare that you can't do this merger or these tariffs are in place. So he's not so much worried about national security as he's worried about lacking the support needed to support these actions. It's interesting with, you know, the Qualcomm broadband dynamic because, of course, these two companies have been fighting kind of for supremacy for a long time. There was a lot of wars about patents. There was a lot of wars about them, you know, stealing one another's intellectual property, and a lot of lawsuits is related to it. Yeah. And now they're now he's blocking by executive order this purchase. And this kind of goes to the heart of that America first. The idea is that, well, you know, if a foreign company can buy an American company, just on that basis alone, it must be blocked. It doesn't matter how it impacts workers. It doesn't matter how it impacts economy. It doesn't matter how it impacts people. It is inconsistent with my ideology that everything in America needs to be, quotes, American, and therefore this particular move needs to be blocked.
John, we're seeing a disturbing trend. And the trend of the kind of xenophobia and nationalism, and it's just pure demagogy because it's not the reason jobs are being lost.
That's right.
We've seen this before. We saw it before World War II. This kind of fanning the flames of xenophobic nationalism, demagogically creating hatred against other countries or other peoples or other workers, and binding everybody together. I'm a steel worker, and so I'm now going to be close to my steel bosses, who my union used to tell me were my enemy.
That's right.
And indeed are my enemy in almost all ways, because they want higher profits and I want higher wages. They want higher profits and I want better benefits. I mean, one pays for the other. You know, it comes from the same pot. It's dangerous because it leads to other outcomes. And I think we're in the beginning of a process. We see it in Europe. They call it the rise of so-called populism. It's not really populism. It's an extreme form of xenophobic, anti-immigrant, anti-other countries, anti-other. And it leads down a dangerous road, which ultimately leads to war. I mean, ultimately, because we're not even in the middle of a big economic contraction right now.
No.
We're not in a big recession.
No, things are actually pretty good,
Just think if the unemployment, which it will go back up because it's the nature of the capitalist boom-bust cycle. That's going to happen again. There's going to be another recession, maybe a depression. Millions of people will lose their jobs, not because they've done something wrong, but they're just caught up as the sort of the blind side of the economic cycle. Then the nationalism takes on an extreme venom, in fact, and it makes it more subject for right-wing, ultra-right, and even fascist movements to sort of capture the population. Let's go back to the good old days. Let's
right.
make America great again, or make Italy great again. I mean, that would have been Mussolini's theme, or
sure.
Germany's theme. Make Germany great again. I mean, you know, without overstating it, without being hyperbolic about it, it's real. This is real stuff. And we have to have, Daniel, another way to go. And part of our series on every week about economics is not only to analyze and assess what's going on, but to also try to offer some clues as to another way of thinking about things, because how we think, what our consciousness is about things actually makes a big difference. if steel jobs are being lost because of worker productivity, meaning because of robots, because of automation, because of advanced technology, if fewer steel workers are needed in the United States, blaming Chinese people or any other people isn't a solution. There has to be some way to organize the economy so that workers who lose their jobs because of productivity, if their jobs become redundant, that those people are not left on the garbage heap. In other words, they have to have a guaranteed income, they have to have housing, they have to have health care. And it's not just in steel. We're seeing this, Daniel, throughout all of the different industrial sectors as a consequence of the revolution in computers and technology and electronics.
Yeah, I think it's really important when we look at these workers who are getting kind of drawn into Donald Trump's net is that the vast majority of people, they're not racist. They don't hate these other countries. But what they are is scared and desperate for work. They're poor and they're seeing a generation of their children who don't have it as good as they did, who have less opportunities, and they're frightened. And someone like Donald Trump can come in and can blame the immigrant. And so there's this popular narrative that, you know, all these people that support Donald Trump are stupid, that they're racist, that they're ignorant, that they didn't go to high school, et cetera, et cetera. And the reality is they're none of those things. They don't want this, you know, violent confrontation with other countries, but they believe that this is the only way they have to get some kind of stability, to get some kind of productivity, to get some jobs and security in their space. And so they're desperate. They'll do what they need to do to what they think they need to do to survive. The reality is that as automation grows, and it is growing and growing, I mean, if self-driving cars come into play, you know, millions of people will lose their jobs that work in the commercial trucking industry. We need to develop a society wherein the way wealth is shared and organized is profoundly and fundamentally different, where wealth is not owned privately by the tiny group of Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates and Donald Trumps, but is owned by the society that created that wealth, that the society that created that wealth, that put it together, can benefit from it, can gain healthcare, can gain education, can gain living wages, can gain regular jobs, and that the society that produces the wealth will use that wealth to take care of itself and to benefit itself, rather than to benefit, you know, these tiny few at the very top of the heap. This is absolutely necessary because the way automation is moving, this society will crumble apart based on how it's currently organized if wealth continues to flow upwards in the way it is. There simply won't be enough for the vast majority of people in the United States, and that's not a future we can have. We need a future where those people can benefit from that wealth, can own that wealth, and can use it to, you know, improve their lives and lead long and meaningful lives.
Yes, something has to give at some point.
Yeah.
He's right. We can't keep this up.
And you look at technology, you think of the washing machine, which was a huge technological boost. That meant labor in the home in particular became less onerous instead of hand washing clothes. It was a step forward. Why is it in society that we see technological advances in the workplace as simply a way to reduce the workforce, and then every worker has to take care of themselves, even though, again, it's not their fault. They're being laid off because of automation and technological advances. But society has no obligation to the individual. Society only, and society's laws seem to only exist to protect the investor class, those who are going to make money from the automation that takes other people's jobs. And we could look at automation and technological advances in a lot of different ways. Like if you need fewer workers to work in a factory producing steel or cars or whatever, if you had a rationally organized economy, you could say, okay, we don't need to be working 14-hour days that has happened in the 19th century. We don't even have to work 8-hour days. We could work 4-hour days. There could be a rational way where instead of some part of the population, maybe the majority being the losers, and then there'd be a small part of the population that's the winners, you can have a situation where the people have more time for leisure, more time for education, more time for their kids, more time for recreation, more time for sports. But if we're in this dog-eat-dog world and the jobs are vanishing, again, as a consequence of processes that we don't control, society has to take that into account. But of course, it won't, because if you look at the political leaders, if it's left to them, they're not going to take anything because the lobbyists who pay them constantly are the same corporations that are benefiting from these technological innovations that enhance profits but diminish the standing of working people.
Yeah, we call that the American way, but the truth is that it's the corrupt way. It's a government that's based on corruption, even though most people here in Washington wouldn't call it corruption. That's really what it is.
Yeah, and you know, let's talk about universal basic income. It's not even really, even though the right wing will call it a socialist demand, it's not even a socialist demand. We have unemployment insurance, which at one time was considered a utopian dream. If you got laid off, you still collect half your gross income for 6 months before you get another job. Social Security, that was considered utopian before 1935. Even public education was considered. Now we consider these to be basic rights. What about the possibility of making sure that every human being in society, whether their job disappears or not, has a guaranteed income?
Yeah, I think that's a new and popular opinion, universal basic income, or UBI, that's grown up. It's certainly, I work in the tech industry, and it's certainly popular here. I think that's because more and more tech workers realize how much they're automating away jobs and how that should be something that's exciting and good and foster innovation and encourage people to make work easier, to make lives simpler, that that's something that we should promote. But in absence of something like universal basic income, automating away those jobs is a terrifying thing. It's horrible, and it frightens people and then hangs them out to dry. So universal basic income, the idea that you have a right to, you know, basic needs, food, clothing, shelter, healthcare, et cetera, just by virtue of the fact that you exist as a human being and by virtue of the fact that our society has sufficient wealth to do it. We've produced an amazing amount of wealth. There's no reason why we can't share that in a way that allows people to live lives with dignity. So this is more and more, I'm seeing it and hearing about it coming up as people start to realize that, you know, this is a zero-sum game if we just continue under the current way of organizing wealth by automating away every job that exists, that we need to provide an alternative for people whose jobs are no longer necessary because, you know, machines can do them better and more efficiently. And that shouldn't be a terrifying thing.
I'm glad we're having this discussion, John. It's the big picture. It helps us cut through the demagogy, and the demagogy is dangerous. But again, we're out of time. Every Tuesday, we're joined by Daniel Sankey, financial policy analyst. He joins us from San Francisco. We take a look at the big economic issues of the week. So every Tuesday, know this is where you can learn about, well, it's about the economy, it's about us, it's about our lives, it's about how we organize society. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.